Here we are.
Hello, Foreign Entanglements viewers. I am Rob Farley, Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce, and with me is Mike Cohen. How are you doing today, Michael?
I am good. I am, again, Michael Cohen. I'm a fellow at the Century Foundation, columnist at The Guardian, and unfortunately, recently departed contestant in Twitter Fight Club, so I'm very kind of sad about that today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's get a. I don't know if this will actually post before, but let's get a quick plug in for Twitter Fighter Club, especially or Twitter Fight Club, and especially for Caitlin, who has Kaideed on Twitter, who has just been fantastic in terms of making Twitter Fight Club happen.
Yes, no, Caitlin is phenomenal, and I give her lots of credit for the time she's taken to develop the Twitter Fight Club. So, you know, good for her, and right. You know, vote early and often is my advice.
No, exactly. I mean, I was able to defeat Ali Gharib handily by an incredibly slim margin in the first round, and then I fell to Laura in the second round, Texas and Africa. She's just juggernaut. She's just taking people apart. So
it's true. And I lost to Blake Hanschel, who is a juggernaut in the Twitter Fight Club. So anyway, we could talk Twitter Fight Club all day, but there's so much stuff going on in the world to talk about, right?
Right, so there's so much stuff going on in the world that let's talk about something that happened, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Okay,
so
let's do that.
You had this article column that came out last week that talked about sort of what are the lessons of Iraq? You know, it was one of many articles that came out. What are the lessons? What lessons have we learned from the Iraq experience?
Right.
That connected sort of the military lessons we learned in Iraq to the surge in Afghanistan, right, and sort of made the argument that this was an example that we had not appropriately learned from the military failure in Iraq.
Right.
I guess give that a little bit more detail, and give that a little bit more justice, and then I'll explain why you're wrong.
Okay, that's good. Well, first of all, I mean, the key argument that I made was that we basically lost the war in Iraq. And, you know, I used the criteria of the Bush administration, which was to basically protect Americans from weapons of mass destruction and from, you know, Saddam Hussein and his alleged links to terrorism. And, you know, my basic take on the war is that it didn't make us safer at all. And, you know, we should have known that in advance. Some of us did argue that. And that even if Iraq, you know, turns into a Jeffersonian democracy, you know, which I sort of doubt will happen, but even if it turns into a stable country, it certainly doesn't justify going to war in the first place, and certainly isn't something that really was worth the cost, at least in the sense of the benefit it provided to U.S. national security.
Right.
And the reason I argue this, and the reason why I sort of harp on this point about us having lost the war, is I think, you know, it's like an addict. You have to sort of recognize, in order to sort of to fix your behavior, you kind of have to recognize you have a problem in the first place. And and I think, in the case of Iraq, we haven't really, as a country, I think, fully appreciated the extent to which we lost in Iraq and the extent to which Iraq was a failure, not just of military means, but a failure, I think, of strategic thinking.
Right.
And I think it was based on a number of just false assumptions about what American military power could achieve, about the nature of threats that we confront in the world, about how we define our national security interests. And, you know, that to me is the more important lesson about whether or not even Saddam had WMD. Even if Saddam did have WMD, it still wouldn't justify going to war. And I actually thought that he did have them. So from that point, I sort of argue that, you know, those assumptions that underpinned the Iraq War are the same flawed assumptions that we made when we surged in Afghanistan. We overinflated the threat that came from Afghanistan. We adopted sort of an absolutist kind of point of view on force posture as far as having to put troops on the ground versus, you know, containing the Taliban, containing al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, or in the case of Iraq, containing Saddam. And I think, you know, that those flawed assumptions, I think because we didn't recognize them about Iraq, we didn't recognize the mistakes we made in imagination before getting into Iraq, contributed to the mistakes we made in Afghanistan. Because I think we took the wrong lessons from Iraq, which is that, hey, look, we learned how to do counterinsurgency. Right. We can do it in Afghanistan. So that's kind of the connection that I see. I see it as a larger sort of systemic failure in American foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, I and we talked about this a little bit earlier, and we talked a little bit on Twitter. I mean, I find that connection, the connection to Afghanistan, deeply strained in this logic. I mean, there's nothing about the Iraq question that anything you just said that I disagree with, right? It's in suggesting that there is some sort of useful parallel between 2009 and 2003 You know, we can say that there were, you know, there were sort of strategic errors in both 2009 and 2003. Although, I mean, we should also recognize that that there are still elements of the jury that have to come in on 2009, right? I mean, we don't have a full story about 2009 in the same way that we
talk
about 2003. But that sort of the language you're using, right, containment of the Taliban, that we thought that there was some sort of military solution in Afghanistan in 2009 and in the same way that we thought in 2003, just seems to me to completely abstract to what the actual U.S. experience in Afghanistan was, right, which was, of course, that we had been involved in a war in Afghanistan for 8 years already, right? And so, you know, what the relevant lessons that people were trying to learn and that people were drawing in 2009 were not the lessons of 2003, in which I think many of the military authorities had already agreed that the raiding strategy of 2003 to Iraq and then trying to leave quickly was a terrible mistake, and had sort of then taken the lesson from it that you have to adopt a robust force posture, and then applied that probably incorrectly to Afghanistan in 2009, right?
Probably.
But it seems, you know, I mean, again, I think that the jury, you know, 10 years from 10 year in 2019, if the Karzai regime, or the successor of the Karzai regime, is still there, and it still holds Kabul, and the Taliban are, you know, still conducting a variety of different insurgency, I mean, people are not probably going to assess that this was a failure.
Right? Well, but
I mean,
they should.
They're going to call it a hiccup.
But would you say okay? But would you say if in 2019 Iraq is a democracy, if people then would turn around and say that? Sorry, that's my phone. People to say this was a success, that they're correct? I mean, would you sort of take the same point of view on Iraq from the perspective of it turns into sort of liberal democracy?
I think that the goals with regards to Afghanistan in 2009 were wholly different than the goals with regards to Iraq in 2003. And that because those goals were different, then they have to be assessed differently, right? And in 2009, one of the key goals was maintaining the survival of the Allied regime in Kabul. And so
right.
I think you're going to look forward to 2019 and people are going to say, well, okay, did the regime in Kabul survive? And
right.
if the regime in Kabul survived, people are going to say, oh, well, you know, okay, maybe elements of the surge into Afghanistan were mistaken. Maybe it didn't have to happen. But hey, the regime survived. Our Allied regime survived. So let's not complain over much about it.
Well, I guess here's the problem I have a little bit with that argument. I mean, there's twofold problems here. One is that the fundamental error that we made in 2003, I would argue, is that we overinflated the threat that we faced from Iraq, right? We assumed that because Iraq had WMD in the past, that they would potentially use in the future and give it to terrorists, you know, because of what happened on 9/11. I mean, that is a bastardized version of what happened. That's basically the point of view that existed. My
right.
argument on Afghanistan has always been, and always was at the time, that the threat that emanated from Afghanistan was at best minimal, and was easily containable, and was containable through a whole host of, you know, force packages other than trying to put 30,000 troops on the ground and fight a counterinsurgency. So, you know, to me, the fundamental flaw that links – there's a number, but the first flaw that links Iraq and Afghanistan – is the failure of assessing threats to U.S. national security interests properly, right? And so I think, you know, while I realize that we're talking about wars that were at different junctures, you know, mm-hmm. it to me it reflects a very similar failure of policymakers to look at the potential threats to the U.S. in a manner that is judicious and is appropriate. So that's the first problem. The second problem is assuming.
I mean, let me stop
sure,
there.
Go
we'll
ahead.
Get to your, we'll get to your
go
we'll
ahead.
Get to your second problem in a little bit, right? I mean, I concur that the threat from Afghanistan, say in 2001, but even threats in 2009, were the Taliban to sort of regain the control of Kabul and so forth. That the threat is probably limited given a reasonable set of, you know, fairly small-scale steps in terms of engaging in, you know, various counter-terror activities, limiting the ability of the Taliban regime to interact with al-Qaeda and so forth. But again, that's not the choice that faced us. I mean, the choice that you're sort of talking here as if in 2009 we had this choice to go and start a war in Afghanistan, and we just kind of went and started a war in Afghanistan because, hey, we didn't think containment would work. But that's, I mean, that's not what happened, right? We had an alliance.
Of course, it's what happened. Of course,
no,
what
how many troops? Yes, exactly. But you know, in Iraq, we did a lot more than doubled troop levels in 2003, right?
Okay.
We went from zero to 150,000, right? In Afghanistan in 2009, we went from 60,000 to 90,000, right?
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, well, or 50,000 or 100,000, right? Whatever number you want to use, right? These are entirely different types of strategic decisions. They are entirely different types of military operations, right? I mean, the United States was already engaged in a war, had an allied regime in Afghanistan, right? Yeah, you're right that sort of backing off of support for that regime, that even if that regime falls, right, even if the Kabul regime collapses and the United States completely withdraws in 2009, which I'm not actually sure you're arguing, but let's say that that's what you're arguing. The Kabul regime falls and the Taliban takes over. This is not such a disaster for American foreign policy. I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting
to. Here's the thing. You can argue, and I agree with you, that these are different military inflection points, right? I mean, the decision to invade an occupied country is not the same thing as the decision to ramp up a counterinsurgency effort. And I get that, and I recognize the difference. My argument, though, is that the decision making that informed the going to war in Iraq and that informed the decision to surge in Afghanistan were based on similarly flawed assumptions and understandings of the world, understandings of the nature of the threat of terrorism. Okay, so I think, you know, if you look back on Iraq, right, properly, and you say that Iraq was not a threat, that Iraq was containable, the consequences of putting troops on the ground in Iraq would lead to unforeseen consequences. The consequences would be the negative consequences, I think, were not taken into account. And, you know, the limitations of what an American military could do on the ground in Iraq in 2003 versus, you know, as far as occupying the country, as far as nation building, had we taken the lesson from that into Afghanistan in 2009, we would have approached it, I think, very differently. I mean, what I find amazing about what happened in Afghanistan in 2009 was that it was informed by what allegedly happened during the surge, that we supposedly put more troops on the ground, and this contributed to, you know, more stability. What was ignored is the previous years in which the country had fallen apart and we had shown ourselves completely incapable of doing effective nation building. That lesson was ignored completely. So to my mind, the key takeaway.
I honestly don't think that you are correctly characterizing what happened in the United States military between.
I'm not actually characterizing you as military. Hold on. I'm characterizing the views of policymakers. I am not characterizing the views of the military, although I think we disagree a little bit on how the military took away the lessons from Iraq into Afghanistan. We can talk about that if you want to. But my argument is
think that the decisions and the arguments made by policymakers in 2009 were, in fact, informed by the experience of the U.S. military in Iraq between 2003 and 2007, right?
They were not. They were informed by a false narrative of what happened in Iraq in 2003 and 2007.
Between 2003 and 2007? I mean,
yes.
I think everyone in 2009, everyone who was debating, everyone who was trying to figure out what to do with Afghanistan, almost universally had the agreement that the United States put too few troops and use them inappropriately in Iraq between 2003 and 2007, and this led to disaster.
That's the wrong lesson. That's the wrong lesson to take away from it. That's not why Iraq became stable or became more stable or civilian fatalities declined after 2007.
Michael, Iraq became unstable after 2003 and remained unstable until 2007 because the United States eliminated the regime that was there, right? I mean, that's fundamentally why Iraq became unstable, right? The United States did that in Afghanistan in 2001, right? So that die was already played, right? There was no way to unplay that in 2009.
I'm not arguing that there was. I mean, I'm not making that argument.
So you're still again, you know, you have mentioned that, you know, we have wars here that are different inflection points. That's really relevant here, right? And that's why your comparison is not useful, in my view. Right, is that you are talking about wars here that are at such different inflection points that it is not, to my mind, terribly useful to sort of think about what are the lessons of 2003 for Iraq and apply them to 2009 in Afghanistan. I think it's better to say we mislearned the lessons of 2007 in the application to 2009. I think that's a much more useful way of approaching
it. We mislearned the lessons of 2007. Right. I mean, look, the entire counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan was based on a false narrative of what happened in Iraq. And I mean, I've written about this quite a bit. I mean, right. This is not a controversial notion. I mean, we simply came to believe that the surge in Iraq and the adoption supposedly of counterinsurgency, population-centric counterinsurgency tactics is what led to a decline in civilian casualties and a decline in violence in Iraq, and that could be transmitted to Afghanistan. And we know that's not accurate. I mean, we know that the U.S. surge certainly had an impact, but it was not decisive, and the agency lies much more with Iraqis than with Americans. But I think maybe you're being too narrow in how you're looking at this. I mean, I don't disagree with you that you're looking at different inflection points and you're looking at different the nature of the conflicts were very different in 2003 in Iraq and because there was no conflict yet and in 2009 Afghanistan. But my argument is a larger one about how policymakers, you know, assess threats, how they assess the efficacy of using military force. And in my mind, what happened in 2003 was that, you know, we overemphasized the threat that existed from Saddam, from terrorism in general, and that flawed assumption drove the decision, you know, or certainly informed the decision to surge in Afghanistan in 2009. Okay, I can go back and look at this. I mean, Obama talked all the time about 9/11 and the threat from Al Qaeda in justifying intervening in Afghanistan. Okay,
Obama did not intervene in Afghanistan. It's fundamentally surging in Afghanistan, right? It was a different environment, right?
But
the
war
was
put
already
troops
there.
Into places in Afghanistan in 2009 that we had not put troops before. Okay, we
oh sure
sent
yes.
Significant troops to Helmand Province.
We had fought in Helmand Province various times.
We were fighting
in all of these places at once.
We were not fighting in Helmand anywhere close to the level we were fighting.
Exactly. It's an escalation. It's an escalation of a war designed to solve the problem of the fact that we were in the middle of a war. Right.
I get that. I mean, but
that's what the decision in 2009 is. Right. It's about how do we sort out the fact that we have this war and it's not going particularly well. Right. And, you know, one solution may be, well, let's draw back to a counter-terror strategy. Another solution may be, let's withdraw entirely. Another solution is to escalate, right? But the war keeps happening no matter what, right? I mean, utilization of military means.
I'm not disputing the point that the war still goes on. I'm disputing the assumptions and the mindset of policymakers when they approach this issue. And mm-hmm. in my mind, they had the same blind spots about what force could accomplish, about the nature of the threats, about, you know, the ability to put in place a military solution in Afghanistan that they made in Iraq in 2003. Now, I'm going to grant you all these points. These are going to be different situations, but, you know, I'm making a larger argument here about how policymakers misunderstand, the nature of threats that we face. They misunderstand how effective military engagement can be in furthering U.S. national security interests. And they disregard, you know, non-military solutions to these kind of challenges, to security challenges.
But there is no non-military solution.
Let me say one more thing. This is important because there's a constancy there in that from 2001 and 9/11 to 2009 mm-hmm. in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And what I would argue and what I've argued in that piece and elsewhere is that if you go before 9/11, that kind of mindset didn't really exist. Right? I mean, policymakers were much more skeptical about the use of force. They were much more solicitous of non-military approaches to dealing with security challenges. We saw this in Iraq from 91 to 2001.
Right. I would say that across the 90s, you see a steady decline of skepticism, right? That 9/11 is an inflection point, right? But that across the 90s, you see a general decline in skepticism of force.
I agree.
The argument you're making here that, in 2003 we thought that the military could change societies, and in 2003 we thought that there was a military solution to security problems, and in 2009 we still did. I mean, that argument leaves me just so cold, right? I mean, it explains, you know, almost. I told you we were going to fight here, right? No, I warned you, we're going to fight. And I mean, the way in which we theorized the way that military force could change society was so different in 2003 than it was in 2009.
But it wasn't.
Michael. In 2003, the theory of military change was this, right? That the United States could remove Saddam Hussein's regime.
Right.
That it could destroy his military. That it could then leave in less than a year and establish a democracy. That was our theory of military change in 2003. The theory of military change in 2009 was that if we stay here with considerable force for the next 20 years, and I think at least on the military side they were pretty explicit about that, if we stay here with a considerable substantial force for like 20 years, then maybe things will work out, right? I mean, these are two completely different theories of how military force changes.
Okay, but you are – the problem you're having here is you're drilling down too much. I mean, I agree with that point. I didn't hear you properly, but you're right. The military theory was very different. But that's not the argument. I'm not talking about, you know, the tactical, you know, notion of how military force is employed. I'm talking about the policymakers looking at both of these situations and drawing at the same wrong conclusion and the same, you know, flawed understanding of the effectiveness of the use of force. And what I'm arguing, and so my point, larger point I'm going to get here, is that we misjudged the nature of the threat facing us in 2003. We misjudged in 2009. My worry is that we will continue to assess, let me finish the point.
We'll continue
to assess threats, to potential security threats, in the same flawed thinking. And we will continue to, my fear is, fetishize military solutions to these potential security threats rather than non-military approaches, which we used to do more of. We used to be much better at thinking about non-military approaches. And when I look at something like Iran, what I see is, you know, an administration that first of all says we can't contain Iran, which is ridiculous. We contained Iraq for 10 years. Of course we contain Iran. We contained nuclear powers for many, many years. And secondly, you have people who are basically saying that the use of force in Iran can be successful in retarding, you know, the Tehran's nuclear program, which is the same, you know, foolish mindset which we exhibited, you know, in 2003 in Iraq and 2009 in different contexts.
I mean, there seems to be far less consensus even within the administration and even within sort of policymaking circles regarding the utility of force against Iran than there was in either 2003 or 2009.
It seems to me
you're going in the right direction.
Well, but the fact that it's even being considered after the disasters that were Iraq and Afghanistan, I find mind-boggling. And I will say to you that mm-hmm. the fact that Obama will not take Iran, force off the table on Iran, he continues to put out there as a possibility. He's basically locked himself into a position where if Iran builds a bomb, he almost is required to use force. And then you think about the fact that if he had lost in 2012, you'd have a president in Romney who almost certainly would be solicitous of the idea of the use of force against Iran. And if the Republican were to win in 2016, you could see that actually end up happening. That to me suggests that the lessons, the failures of Iraq and Afghanistan have not been internalized at all in American foreign policy thinking, that this is even on the table, even being considered. I mean, you know, there's not a pushback against this Iran argument that is basically saying, haven't we learned the lesson that that military force and can only accomplish so much, and that, you know, the threat from Iran doesn't justify going to war against them?
I think there is a pushback, actually, and I think that's okay. Even on policymaking circles, you know, despite the rhetoric of the administration, I think there's considerably less support for the idea of going to war against Iran than either the 2001 decision in Afghanistan, 2003 decision in Iraq, or the incorrect analogy that you're making, the 2009 decision to surge in Afghanistan. And this is important. This is important. And let me explain why this is important. Because the people who wanted to surge in Afghanistan in 2009, even on the military side, and you are drawing far too bright of a distinction between the military side and the civilian side on this, because they go back and forth, for one.
They were much more in tune in 2009 than they were in 2003.
There's no question. Yeah. And the military, the uniformed military, also strongly contributes to civilian debate. Military in 2009, there is no question that at least at the you know, the level of that was relevant for policymaking. This is not to say the entire level, this is not to say every service, this is not to say even every admiral and every general, but at the policy relevant level that they were very strongly in favor of a surge. At the same time, I think you would have seen if you'd had, and I did have conversations with some of these people, and I'm sure you had conversations with these people too, that they were deeply skeptical. They were even more skeptical of 2003 than they had been in 2003. And in 2003, they had been more skeptical than civilians, right? That, you know, within this circle that pushed the surge in 2009, the idea of waging war against Iran was crazy, right? I mean, and I think that these same people would say now the idea of waging war against Iran is crazy, right? And so that's why I have problems in trying to assess, to draw this line that you're talking about here, because to me, it's a line that zigzags all around, right? And it's a line, I guess another way to phrase it, it's not a linear relationship, right? The people who thought that additional force could work in a particular way in Afghanistan in 2009 were not making the same kinds of arguments that were made in 2003, and in fact, they were explicitly rejecting the arguments that were made in 2003.
I'll say again, I grant you that point. I'm not arguing over that point. I grant you that point. That's not the argument that I'm making. I absolutely agree with you that the military approach to both conflicts was completely different. I'm not disputing that. But that's not my argument. My argument is that there's a strategic incoherence in among policymakers in inflating the threat from both countries and you know not rejecting non-military approaches to dealing with Iraq and Afghanistan. And the thing about Iraq, I'm just going to say on Iran, that's really, really important here, and I think the point that you're kind of missing a little bit is that, you know, this administration, which I believe does not want to go to war in Iran, has nonetheless rejected containment as a potential a response to an Iranian nuclear weapon, which is an insanely foolish position to take. Because, you know, first of all, we have a great deal of experience in containing nuclear powers, as you and I have discussed in the past. Secondly, we contained Iraq quite effectively before 2003. And to me, the lesson to take away from Iraq was that containment of Iraq, even as flawed as that was a much more preferable option than going to war against them, okay, because of all of the unforeseen consequences that come from the use of military force. That lesson does not seem to be imparted upon policymakers. I don't see anybody in the Republican Party who believes this. Anyone in the Republican Party who accepts the idea of containment. And
I'm sorry. Senator Rand Paul was here yesterday. I believe he accepts that.
Okay, so that's the only one.
Talking to us. He's actually not the only one, right? I mean, I think he speaks for – I mean, frankly, I think he probably – that Senator McConnell. McConnell will never say this. Not in his nature to say this. But I think that, for example, Senator McConnell probably holds very similar views to Paul on these – a lot of Republicans do.
He might.
Right. But they don't vocalize them in the same way that Paul does. But that's it. We're going to come back to that. We have a Kentucky session at the
end. We do a Kentucky session here. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I understand your point here, but I guess that it seems to me that you are not just comparing apples with oranges, which I should say is a metaphor that I hate, because why couldn't you compare apples and oranges? Right. I mean, you should be able to compare apples and oranges, right? They're two fruit. They're right there next to each other. You're like comparing apples and eggs, right? Which is a much more problematic.
Apples and bicycles. To sort of
draw this out, you know, for some reason we seem to be about to go to war with North Korea, right? For reasons that, you know, seems to be, you know, utterly not understandable from our point of view, right?
Yeah.
And you know what I see here. In terms of, you know, that we've stepped up B-52 flights, we've stepped up B-2 flights. I think it's unlikely we're going to go to war with North Korea. It seems to be a horrifically absurd notion that we're going to war with North Korea. But when I see us, you know, engaging in these B-52 flights, I say to myself, well, I mean, this is pretty standard defense strategic statecraft, right? That is not at all out of sorts with how the United States has thought about force since even since the Vietnam War, right? Since 1975. And so when I see people talking about the relationship with North Korea in militarized terms, I say, well, military has to be part of this conversation, right? I mean, it's not all of the conversation, and the United States should not go to war against North Korea unless North Korea attacks the United States. You know, military options have to be somewhere, right? We have to be thinking in these terms. And, you know, that seems to me just sort of bog standard statecraft rather than has something that has a linear relationship from 2003 to 2009 to, you know, the great 2013 re-engagement of the Korean War. And I guess I sort of think about the Iran thing in the same way, right? I mean,
that doesn't make any sense. I mean, we're actually, like, legally at war with North Korea. I mean, we're legally we have 34,000 troops along the Korean border. They have nuclear weapons. They could potentially attack a key ally of ours. I mean, Iran doesn't offer any of the same challenge to the United States or anybody else in the region, for that matter. They're a third-rate military power.
Oh, I agree completely. There's no disagreement here.
So I guess I'm not seeing the North Korea analogy to what I mean, because I haven't, you know, I mean,
the emotional experience you're having right now, not being able to understand the analogy, is the same emotional experience I've been having for most of this conversation.
Well, I mean, you know, okay, I guess the problem I'm having here is that, you know, you really are comparing apples and bicycles. I mean, you're comparing a country that has a nuclear weapon, a country that does not have a nuclear weapon, right? Use Korea as an example. We didn't go to war against North Korea to stop them from getting a nuclear bomb in 2002. In fact, we basically ignored it. And guess what? They built a nuclear bomb, and, you know, it didn't have much effect on the Korean Peninsula as far as the strategic impact of that. Now, I you and I have argued in the past, and I do believe that Iran getting a bomb would have a much different impact in the Middle East than it does in the Far East. But nonetheless, we have plenty of evidence, Korea being one example, that we are able to contain nuclear powers, right?
Right.
I mean, that is the tradition, that is the legacy of the Cold War in key regards, that we have shown an ability to we understand how to contain a nuclear power like Iran. And for some reason, those lessons seem to be completely have forgotten by American policymakers.
Let's use this as a transition to the next point, right? I mean, what if I were to say that Obama almost certainly understands that a nuclear Iran can be contained, that Biden almost certainly understands that a nuclear Iran can be contained, that probably most of the key policymakers in the administration understand that a nuclear Iran can be contained, and that what we're seeing right now is rhetoric, right? And which is not to say you can't point yourself into a rhetorical box, but what we're really seeing right now is rhetoric and not sort of, as you have suggested, this sort of kind of flawed mindset. And I think this drags us into what we're going to talk about next, which is Obama's trip to Israel.
Okay, but before we do that, look, that's a slippery argument that I reject. I mean, you're right, and I agree with you, this administration does not want to believe containment would work and doesn't want to go to war with Iran. The fact that they can't say that, it should be troubling to both of us, troubling to everybody, to all of us concerned about the possibility of a war with Iran. You know, the fact is that by saying Iran is not containable, by saying force on the table, you know, they have basically explicitly validated that strategy being adopted by a future Republican administration. Okay, Republicans will, if they were to win 2016, they would, and they want to go to war against Iran. It wasn't Rand Paul who was the Republican president. They would use Obama's rhetoric on Iran as justification for doing so. They'd say, "Look what Obama said. He said you can't contain Iran's nuclear program." So,
you're right.
I just step back one day. I approach this issue from a very sort of like 50,000 foot view, which just says that you know this piece I wrote for Foreign Affairs last year about threat assessment, and this is a big part of my the way I think about foreign policy and national security. We habitually misunderstand threats and misunderstand challenges, okay? And to me, that failure to misunderstand potential threats is maybe our most significant foreign policy failure, but maybe failure of imagination among policymakers, okay? And that's the link that I see between – I mean, I see other links, but that's the main link I see between Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran, okay? Then in all three places, we exaggerate the potential threat of these countries, you know, that they represent to the U.S., whether it's nuclear weapons, whether it's weapons of mass destruction, whether it's terrorism. And because we misunderstand the threats, we make really poor decisions. And those poor decisions, I can, you know, 2003 going to war against Iraq, 2009 going to war against Afghanistan, 2017 going to war against Iran, who knows?
In 2009, we didn't go to war against Afghanistan. We were already at war.
Sorry. Let me rephrase that. Escalating the war in Afghanistan in a foolish effort that has failed and that has cost many American lives and done very little to further U.S. national security interests. I mean, that is, to me, the flawed thinking is identical among all three. And I get your point, you know, there are different inflection points in these conflicts, but until we start thinking about the world as it really is, and threats as they really are, we're going to keep making these stupid decisions to go to war. And we're going to keep putting our military in places they shouldn't be in order to fight wars that don't further our national interest. That's my concern, and that's the link that I see between all of these conflicts, all of these past conflicts and possibly future conflicts and present conflicts.
I mean, I guess, I don't think that there's anything exceptional about the United States in this regard, right, beyond the fact that the United States has the capability to put troops anywhere in the world, right? I mean, I think that states make errors of threat assessment all the time in all kinds of different states. Errors of threat assessment,
but that's not really that's not really a response. I mean, you're saying that right. Everyone does it isn't really.
Well,
an
it's an international, it's an international relations way.
But I would say that there's a very strong legacy in American diplomacy, in American foreign policy, mm-hmm. of actually of not overreacting to threats. Okay, I mean, I know this may sound an odd thing to say, but you know, if you look at the history of the Cold War from Truman to the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were places where we exaggerated threats and we made terrible mistakes, and Vietnam is the obvious example of that. But there were plenty of places where threats were inflated, and policymakers wisely didn't take the bait. And the Cuban Missile Crisis is the most obvious example, but you could, you know, Dien Bien Phu before with Eisenhower, Laos in 61
not every threat inflation leads to war, right? I mean, it's easily arguable that the Cuban Missile Crisis was all about threat inflation that almost led to war, right? And that you know, in fact, what the Kennedy administration, the reason we had a crisis in the first place is because the Kennedy administration decided to engage in radical threat inflation, right? That the alternative here was not, oh, threat inflation leads to war. It's don't inflate threats, and there was never a Cuban Missile Crisis in the first place. Right, and, you know,
I think it's also easily arguable that
the Korean War is about threat inflation, right? The entire Cold War, this argument has certainly been made, the entire Cold War
yes.
is about threat inflation.
Absolutely.
And deliberate threat inflation on the part of the Truman administration.
Absolutely.
To scare the hell out of the American people.
The entire Cold War, I agree with you.
I should say, I don't entirely agree with that, right, but the argument has been made.
Right, and I should say that I don't entirely, I mean, I agree that the threat inflation from the Cold War, it's not entirely threat inflation, but it's certainly a big part of it is threat inflation. However, my point I'm making here is that we have consistently throughout history demonstrated a judicious use of military power, you know, because we've assessed, we've made sort of proper cost-benefit analysis in the use of military force. I mean, I would say that, you know, that Eisenhower and Kennedy and Reagan and to some extent the first Bush and Clinton all, you know, looked at sort of the cost of going to war and or said the benefits are not worth it. I fear that the balance has shifted in that we sort of don't kind of grasp fully the cost of war and we overinflate the benefits of military engagement. And you know, I'm a big devotee of the Powell Doctrine and the, I should mm-hmm. say the Weinberger Doctrine and later the Powell Doctrine in the sense that, you know, that was a doctrine that basically was a check on use of military force, and it was one that I think more properly took into account actual U.S. national security interests into whether or not we should use force in the first place. And I don't feel like we've lost touch with that, and that's what worries me about the debate about Iran is that you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I interpret the Powell Doctrine as entirely different. Right? That the Powell Doctrine is an effort by the uniformed military to restrict. Policy making freedom of civilians policy.
Okay, but policymakers willingly accepted that prison.
Oh, sure.
Three presidents: why Reagan, Bush, and Clinton all willingly accepted that, and they embraced.
Well, they were willing to live within the restrictions that the uniformed military had set with them to a certain extent.
No,
that doesn't mean
that's not
that
no.
it wasn't that didn't mean that doesn't mean that it wasn't the or th- that they accepted it. Is not to say that there wasn't a very specific, very particular effort to create those limits.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Weinberger Doctrine. He said it. I mean, I know he was informed by Colin Powell. I get that. But there was a sense within all three of these administrations that we had to be, again, much more judicious about the use of force. And I would argue that in 01, we threw that out the window completely. You know, not just on Iraq, but to some extent in Afghanistan as well. And, you know, we have to get back to a mindset when we think about use of force that is more rational, and we've lost that. I mean, that's what I look at this Iran debate, and I see. I'm sort of. It's amazing to me People just don't say, this is a stupid idea. Like, and policymakers don't say this. Politicians well, don't but, say it. I know people say privately.
People I mean, a lot of people do. I don't know. You do. I do.
Who listens to us? I mean, hopefully, you know, a few people. But, I mean, we're not
our
the
seven commenters. The seven commenters of Foreign Entanglements listen to us. Let's not.
Right. And look,
don't,
and you and I.
Don't
I'm sure,
try to eliminate their experience, their lived experience, Michael. I mean, that's.
Okay, I don't mean to, obviously, but I'm saying, and I appreciate them listening, I really do. But you know, you and I wasn't writing on this publicly in 2003, mm-hmm. but I was opposed to the Iraq War. I'm sure you were as well. Nobody listened to us, right? I mean, a lot of academics, a lot of smart people said, "We're going to war in Iraq is a really stupid effing idea," right? And nobody listened to them. And here's the thing too. I mean, I said in 2009 repeatedly that going to war, surging in Afghanistan. Putting more troops down is a really stupid idea, and it's going to lead to disaster. Maybe not disaster, but certainly not going to work out well. And you know that view was basically, I think, has been confirmed. And to a large extent, you know, I was in a made significant minority in holding that view and expressing that view, right? And I think if you would look back 10 years earlier on something like Afghanistan, there never would have been that kind of impetus to go to surge in Afghanistan. Look back in '83 in Lebanon and Reagan. I mean, he's after the Marine barracks bombing, he's all right, let's get the hell out of here. I mean. The mindset has changed in a very, in, to my mind, a very damaging way.
I mean, once
way.
Again, Michael, I think that you are comparing apples and orangutan right now. I mean, I think that you're making comparisons that simply don't hold the weight that you want to put on them. But anyway,
okay. I mean, that's fine. We disagree. That's fine.
Can we move on to Israel? Can we move on to?
We can move on.
We have two things we have to talk about: Israel and Kentucky.
They have a lot in common.
Right, exactly. What was your thinking on Obama's trip to Israel?
I mean, my verdict is kind of meh. You know, I thought, look, you know, Israel's in a very the Israel-Palestinian situation is in a very tough spot right now, and in the sense that, okay, this is what I found odd about Obama's speech. Obama gave the speech, where basically said Israelis and Palestinians have to trust each other, and Israelis have to see Palestinians as equals, and they have to accept the idea of a Palestinian state. And, you know, look, the fact is that two-thirds of Israelis, maybe more, accept the idea of a Palestinian state along six, seven borders, right? I mean, they basically recognize that this is something that should happen. The problem is they don't trust the Palestinians, and they don't see a partner for peace, right? So there's this weird divide where you have the same number of Israelis who say we should have a Palestinian state who also say it's never going to happen, or right. similar percentages. Right. So the second part is where Obama needs to focus on, okay? A, convincing Israelis that they have a partner for peace, and B, for actually trying to create a process to make that possible. Okay, he didn't do that. He had one line in that speech about PA and Abbas being partners for peace, which was good, but that should have been really the focal point of what he was talking about, because that's really the issue. And I feel like the speech he gave would have been appropriate, I don't know, 20 years ago. But that in the current sort of situation among Israelis and Palestinians, it's not relevant in the slightest. You know, the two sides are never going to trust each other fully. A deal that happens is a pragmatic deal that is made by Israelis who basically come to the realization that maintaining the status quo is no longer tenable for them, and thus they will give it up. That's how it has to happen. And the only outside force that can make that happen outside of global isolation for Israel is the United States. And I saw nothing from that speech that made me think that the U.S. is going to play that kind of active role. So I came away from the whole thing kind of, you know, meh.
Right, right. I mean, my assessment is similar. While at the, you know, I have my doubts about the ability of the United States to supply either a sufficient pressure to, I mean, because when we talk about two-thirds of Israelis, you know, basically being in favor of this notion of a Palestinian state, you know, that means that a third of Israelis, and I don't know, probably really a growing number of Israelis, is pretty hostile to the notion, right? And these are
sure.
who already live in the West Bank and a part of the population of the West Bank. And of course, we know in democratic politics, it's not simply a case in any country of a generalized democratic preference being translated unproblematically into policy, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I think, you know, broadly the issue within Israeli politics is that, yeah, you have this two-thirds out there that kind of wants a Palestinian state, They don't care about it as much as the one-third that really doesn't want a Palestinian state. And you also have the same problem that this two-thirds, you know, in part because they don't care about it so much, don't believe that it's possible, right? And so this is a situation where I, you know, I'm sort of coming to doubt how much or how efficacious outside pressure can really be in this. Which is, and I should hasten to add this, right, which is not to say that the United States should continue sort of de facto support of, which we really are, right, de facto support of increasing settlements in the West Bank and so forth, right? It's just to say, you know, I myself have significant doubts about the ability of the United States to furnish the conditions for a reasonable compromise.
I have significant doubts as well, but the fact is that becomes an excuse, not an explanation.
Right.
And the way I look at it is this. I mean, you are getting very close to a point, you know, in the foreseeable future in which a Palestinian state is no longer viable. Okay. If, for example, I don't think this is going to happen, but if the Israelis were to decide to build along the E1 corridor, that would make a Palestinian state very hard to achieve. If they continue to build settlements in the West Bank, that'll make it hard for a Palestinian state to ever emerge.
Right.
If the PA dissolves, yes, all these problems. And, you know, that creates a situation for the U.S. that's very damaging in that they're going to be basically the biggest international supporter of a country that is basically a apartheid state. And that is the future that faces the U.S. in the region. Okay. Now, it's possible the U.S. is okay with that. It's possible the U.S. will obfuscate over that point. But at some point, I think, you know, this is a serious challenge for policymakers that, you know, they don't seem to be recognizing. And so if you have an option here, you can basically accept the status quo and accept that Israel is going to become this, you know, illiberal state, an undemocratic state, basically, if it isn't already. If it continues to maintain control of Palestinians, West Bank, and Gaza, or certainly West Bank, but certainly, you know, Cajun, the Palestinians in Gaza, or you actually try to engage in diplomacy and push a peace process forward, okay? Now, I don't actually agree with you that you have to put pressure on the Israelis. I mean, it would help to do that, but I think there's all, and we saw in the Hagel hearings, all kinds of reasons why it's not going to happen, because the political costs are too great. It does not mean that you can't send John Kerry to the region to try to engage in a diplomatic initiative. That might happen. I didn't hear Obama say that in his speech. That would be a useful thing to actually take place, is if there was a follow-up to what Obama said in his speech. But I'm not sure that's going to happen. I hope so. If it happens, then I'll revise my view of it. But unless the U.S. wants to get significantly engaged in this situation, nothing is going to change in the near term. And if it does change, it'll come because there's more violence from the Palestinians, or because, you know, Israel's international isolation will grow, which will not happen soon, but may happen eventually.
Right. I mean, I guess I don't have anything more to contribute than what you just said. I don't think there's anything wrong about what you said. It seems entirely
well,
reasonable. It's just. I mean, I hear what you say and said, oh my God, that's so depressing, right?
Right. If only you could demonstrate such perceptive views in our earlier conversation, we wouldn't have that big argument.
It's like, let's throw John Kerry at the problem and see if something works out, right? And it's like, okay, that's fine.
He is Secretary of State. I mean, you know,
right.
If he can't do it, then who can?
So to the altogether more important and relevant issues of Kentucky politics. Kentucky, and I don't know if it was Anisha or Mother Jones or whatever. There was recently, you know, Kentucky has recently become sort of an epicenter of senatorial politics in the United States. Right, we have two senators, the esteemed Senator McConnell, who's of course the Senate Minority Leader, and Senator Paul. Senator Paul, of course, as you know, as everyone knows, well, no, frankly, let's not say as everyone knows. Let's say as the extraordinarily small minority of people who pay a lot of attention to foreign policy.
Right.
Knows recently engaged in a long filibuster in which he strongly rejected the notion that Americans on American soil should be drone striked by the Obama administration. And there was a little bit more to it than that. But and so there's really some interest here, right? I mean, so Kentucky senators are really getting a lot of attention, or at least Paul is. McConnell doesn't want attention, right?
Right.
McConnell is not the sort of person who wants attention. And then until yesterday, there was the looming question of whether Ashley Judd, Kentucky,
right,
actually she's not a Kentucky native, but a Kentucky associated Ashley Judd
right.
was going to run for Senator McConnell's position in 2014, and this had, you know, it gained a lot of attention. It was fascinating because, you know, there was the prospect here of switching out McConnell for not just a Democrat, but a person who would be one of the most left wing Democrats in
and then
in
some.
The Senate, right? And that hasn't worked out. She announced yesterday that it wasn't going to happen. And you know, people have questioned whether she had a serious chance of McConnell. But you know, I should say that with regards to Kentucky, people who are not from Kentucky dramatically overstate the extent to which Republicans have a lock on the two senators.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, right. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago that Democrats used to win in Kentucky. I think Clinton went there twice, didn't he?
Well, yeah, Clinton. I think Clinton did win here twice, right? Obama got destroyed in both 2008 and 2012. But you know, Senator McConnell won by just a hair's breadth against Bruce Lunsford in 2008 in an election that Lunsford was, you know, fairly widely regarded as a Democratic candidate. In a Republican wave year in 2010, Rand Paul won by a pretty small margin against a stronger Democratic candidate,
in a tough year for Democrats, though.
Right. It was an incredibly tough year for Democrats, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Paul won by a very narrow margin. Similarly, in 2004, the election was very tight between Democrat and Republican. So really, the last three senatorial races in Kentucky have been very tight between Democrats and Republicans.
Right.
Republicans have won all of them. But Mitch McConnell is one of the least popular senators in America, even within Kentucky, right? And so this state that Democrats can win.
But you know, here's what I find fascinating about Kentucky, if I might say. And I've just been thinking about this for a little while, but you have in McConnell and Rand Paul, like the really, like, it sums up the utter dysfunction and nefariousness of the modern Republican Party. And what I mean by that, not dysfunction, nefariousness, and, you know, abject sort of craziness of the current Republican Party. So with McConnell, you have a guy who basically doesn't care at all about policy, right? Who just cares about political power, and is sort of the personification of the obstructionism of Republicans and the extent to which they have basically made American our democracy dysfunctional. I mean, it's funny. I was
that's mostly. I mean, being here, you find out that, yeah, I mean, McConnell does care about something. I mean, so
he cares about people spending money in little campaigns. He cares about that.
Well, but I mean, he has certain commitments. Like he's done a ton of work on the Burma thing, for example. And so there are some things where he actually does have strong commitments.
Okay, but I mean,
that's not his central persona.
Everyone has their pet issues, I suppose.
Right,
Even Nixon had his pet issues. But in general, you know, Mitch McConnell's all about political power. And he's all about the obstructing, you know, Democrats. And again, like, you know, I was just saying this, you know, 20 years, I was reading this book written in 1991 about dysfunction in American politics. And I feel like, and I know the author, like, emailing him saying, you've seen nothing, right? Because what we see now is a political system that is at its most dysfunctional, maybe ever, in American politics. And it is certainly in a sort of post-Civil War era, I suppose you could say. It's a complete disaster, and it's largely because of someone of Mitch McConnell. Now, on the other hand, you have Rand Paul, who really does represent the sort of the nuttiness of the current GOP. And I say that, I don't mean to be kind of too harsh, but you know, look, the drone thing is fascinating in the sense that I don't really think that Rand Paul cares about drones hitting Americans in Yemen. I think he wants to play up the fear among conservatives that Obama is going to send drones against them because he wants to take their guns. I mean, I think that's what drove that filibuster more than anything else. Certainly, the risk of Obama killing someone with a drone, it's just sort of absurd.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is part of an internally coherent vision that Senator Paul and, you know, his father, perhaps even to a greater extent, had with regards to the negotiation between state and local power, between federal, state, local, and private power, which is to say that, you know, broadly speaking, and there are huge exceptions here, but broadly speaking, you know, Rand Paul does not want the federal government to interfere in private decisions, right? Whether this is, and he even said yesterday, he doesn't give a damn how people make contracts for marriages, right? So, in a very libertarian case for gay marriage. He, you know, has said, you know, he said resisting the drug war, right? He said anti-drug war things. And he says anti-drone strike things, right? All of these are about sort of the, you know, preventing the federal government from interfering in the lives of people. Now, he's also pretty explicit that, or he has been in the past, that this also means that the federal government shouldn't be able to interfere in the ability of a shop owner to prevent African Americans from sitting at their at dining tables. And Rand Paul is clear about that. That's how he understands this, and it's internally coherent, and it makes sense to him. And I
can I make one interjection, if I could?
Yeah.
You are correct to the extent to which that argument basically ends where a woman's uterus begins.
Yes. Okay? Yes. You know, and that was going to be that was the next thing I was going to say, right? And
okay. There is good.
This
good.
Gigantic, glaring exception.
Glaring.
With regard. Yeah. No. He,
yes.
And there are some other ones along the way too. There are some other ones along the way, but that's the biggest, right? Really, the biggest one is that. And, you know, well, you know, you can think if you want, you could try to explain that away, right, and say, oh, well, you know, he probably doesn't care that much about the issue. He just can't succeed in public politics being pro-choice these days. Yeah, I haven't really sort of plumbed that, but we should take him at face value, right? If he says that women's uteruses should be the purview of the state, then we should believe him when, you know, he essentially makes that case.
Okay, but that's completely contradictory to his otherwise libertarian views.
Yes,
it's completely
absolutely
contradictory.
Yeah, and so anyway, you know, with that gigantic glaring exception, there's a consistent worldview here from Rand Paul that is, you know, I think to people who paid attention to American politics for a long time, it's not hard to recognize this. I mean, this is sort of a It has Western aspects to it. It has Southern aspects to it. You know, in part why, you know, the Texas connection. And, you know, it's a very old notion of resistance to federal power.
Yeah,
and this
drone
strike thing, this drone strike thing is part of that. It's not surprising that it's part of that. And that's fine. And there are virtues to that, right? Especially the anti-drug war, which is probably the single biggest thing that Americans can't think seriously about, right? I mean, the drug war is so much of a worse thing than drone strikes.
Well, maybe I put climate change above that, but okay.
Right. Well, you know, whatever. But you know, you when you're interpreting what Rand Paul's saying, you have to understand this is where he's coming from, right? And you have to understand that in a lot of ways, this is a bad place, right? This is a bad place that he's coming from, and it's a bad place that's been bad for a very long time.
Yeah,
and this good thing that he kind of wants is great, but you know, it's part of a whole bad package.
It is, and I think one thing that I was really disturbed by was watching so many liberals basically praise Rand Paul because of his drone policy, drone views, and for three reasons. One, his views on drones are a total what's the word I'm looking for? Diversion from the real issues about drones. If he had filibustered on the grounds that I want to see the OLC memo that justifies the killing of al-Awlaki, that would have been great. It's not what he did. He basically played politics on the drones issue. The second problem I have with Paul is the abortion issue, obviously, too. I mean, the fact that liberals are praising this guy on civil liberties when he basically believes that a woman should have control of her own reproductive rights is insane, and it's by the way, a real problem I see in the left in general, in which they sort of make this carve-out for abortion. As if, you know, that we'll make an exception there because he lost firmly held views about it. If you are a liberal and you are a feminist, you know, then you certainly – that is should be a no back down, no retreat on that issue. So I'm always surprised when I see liberals who are strong liberals make this – and even libertarians who harp on Paul's opposition to drones and ignore the fact that he's terrible on abortion issues and reproductive rights.
Right.
And the third thing is – this is the part – the real problem is that, you know, the perspective of liberals – but Rand Paul is terrible on foreign policy. They love to focus on the fact that he's opposed to this military use of force, and I'm all for that. But, you know, he wants to pull out of the UN. He basically wants to cut foreign aid dramatically. I have to check. I think he wants to pull out of NATO. I know his dad wants to pull out of NATO. He is not necessarily an isolationist, but he's certainly in that sort of spectrum of being near an isolationist. And, you know, I understand the idea of not wanting to get involved in a war in Iran, and he was certainly opposed to the surge, and I respect that. But, you know, on a host of foreign policy issues that are much, frankly, in some ways more important, when you think about global architecture, when you think about, you know, burden sharing, when you think about, you know, sort of prone democracy and global public health, things like that, you know, he is in a terrible place on those issues. And that should concern liberals. Because those are issues in which there's not a great deal of political constituency for them. And this is a guy who I fear is going to win the Republican nomination in 2016 and run around the country basically talking about, you know, how we need to apply the UN, how we need to sort of cut back on foreign aid and sort of, you know, step back from the world.
Right.
I have to say, having said all of that, I think actually Rand Paul is, so far, I'm somewhat impressed with him politically. I mean, I'm not impressed with him policy-wise, but politically, this thing on immigration where he basically came out in support ish of a path to citizenship, he is certainly much savvier than Marco Rubio.
Right.
He seems to be, and on the drone thing, even though I think his position was BS, it was very smart politically. It was in the Republican Party.
I would concur with that. Right, that I he has displayed much sounder political instincts.
Yes.
I think than his father, and I think that a lot of people suspected that he would win. And I guess, you know, this really shouldn't be surprising, right? He was able to win a Senate race, and his father would never have been able to win a Senate race. And right? He was able to win in a, you know, in a Republican wave year and in a fairly Republicanish moving state. But still, I mean, you know, he has much defter political
yes, he does.
Instincts than I think anyone gave him credit for in 2010.
And I think I agree with you, and I think that Rand Paul is a he will be a formidable candidate within the Republican Party for the nomination. I do not think he could win a national election, but I think that within the political – and I will say this, though. That I don't think he can win, but you make a point earlier that his sort of anti-centralism that is sort of essential to his political ideology is a very powerful point of view in American politics, and it always has been. I think the problem is that, you know, he's not an operational liberal, obviously, and that often trips up conservatives. But – you know, he talks to talk. He has a good rhetorical template for running for national office. I don't think he can win, but I'll tell you what. Right now, if I were betting on who's the Republican nominee in 2016, I think he's got as good a chance as anybody in that party does.
Oh, I mean, it's going to be fascinating, right? Because to the extent that he becomes more of a genuine, and there are, and we should hasten to add here that he suffers a major handicap in terms of being up for election in 2016 for Kentucky Senate, because Kentucky state law, to my understanding, and people in comments can correct me if I'm wrong, prevent someone from being on both the presidential primary and the senatorial primary.
Interesting.
Right. And Kentucky is a late primary. So, you know, theoretically, and I guess maybe this is the way you square the circle, right, is that, you know, by the time he could win the nomination before you get to Kentucky, right, and that people could write him in on the ballot. And, you know, I guess that's probably all you would need, right? I mean, since Kentucky Republicans would come out and vote for him, there's no question. And so that's maybe how you solve that problem. But there are issues.
But he's clearly running for president. There's no question about it. He's running in 2016.
I think it's going to be really fascinating to watch our friends. I'm using the quotes here, but I don't want to fully use the. I mostly just want to use the quotes here. Our friends in the neoconservative movement, right? You know, which still sort of holds the keys of the foreign policy machine in the Republican Party.
That's right.
Right? And they hold the keys through because they control most of the major think tanks that supply all of the senators and all of the representatives with their foreign policy talking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To what extent they try to co-opt Rand Paul? To what extent they co-opting Rand Paul, and then to what extent, if they can't co-opt Rand Paul, they absolutely go apeshit about the Rand Paul candidates.
Well, here's the great question:
the 2016 primary.
If you're a neocon, right, and you have a choice between Rand Paul and Hillary, who do you support? I mean, it's
That's
not
a really
so obvious.
Question. Yeah,
it's not so obvious. I mean, Hillary she's a really good liberal hawk. If you like liberal hawks, she's as good as they get in the Democratic Party right now. And she's up there. And, you know, if you're a neocon, I mean, you look at that situation, if you care most about foreign policy, Hillary Clinton looks a little more attractive to you than Rand Paul in some key regards. You know, because this is a guy who is the antithesis of a neocon, right, within the Republican Party. which is, by the way, that's the one reason why I think he might not win, because I think that would be a problem for him. I mean, I think what's interesting that he's doing now is he's cultivating this sort of libertarian, you know, kind of wing within the party that is sort of, you know, skeptical of America's role in the world. That's actually not a bad approach to take in the primaries, but you know, it's going to be a problem. He's going to get hit hard from the Rubios of the world for, you know, turning his back on American leadership and such.
Right. It's going to be fun to watch. And you know, if there's one thing that, you know, I live in Kentucky, and so we enjoy the attention paid to Kentucky. Everybody does. But there is just sort of nothing more appealing than the terror which will grip, you know, Bill Kristol's tiny heart as Rand Paul approaches clinching the Republican nomination. Right?
I would agree with our
friend Eli and, you know, everyone else, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of
part of that
movement, you know, sort of watching as this happens and just watching the histrionics
community. You could say that them watching this would be a bit like us we missed the chance, but having been able to watch Ashley Judd run for Senate in Kentucky, which right. would have been, you know, the shit show to end all shit shows. I mean, as a Democrat, I think it would have been terrible. But as a political observer, the joy of watching that race would have been, you know, substantial. I'm kind of bummed she's not running in that sense. It would have been quite a mess if she had actually decided to get in there. I mean, she could never win. And I can only imagine the things that she would say and the ads probably would run against her in Kentucky.
Right, right. She was unlikely to win, right? I mean, she is fairly popular here for a variety of reasons, but she was unlikely to win. Anyway, I mean, we've already kind of gone over time, so
not
that there's really a limit. But thank you, Foreign Tanglements viewers. Thank you, Michael. I think this one has been fantastic, right?
Had a fight. I enjoyed this one, yeah.
Foreign Tanglements viewers, thank you for watching, and tune in next time. And, Michael, we need to do this again soon.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right.